Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist, where your special education questions meet expert answers. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor, a certified educational therapist, special educator, and your go-to special ed strategist, here to collaborate with families to access special education services, ignite student potential, and erase learning gaps. Together, we'll unlock the services and support your kiddo's needs to thrive. Let's get started. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com. Hello, and welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, the place where we meet at the intersection of home and school to make the special education journey feel a little less overwhelming and a lot more empowering. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor, educational therapist, IEP coach, and most importantly, a parent who knows exactly how heavy this work can feel. Today, we're diving into one of the most important and sometimes most daunting parts of raising our neurodivergent kiddos, building daily life skills that are actually stick. So these are skills that make mornings smoother, give our kids more confidence, and help us see a future where they can thrive with as much independence as possible. I'm really pleased to be joined today by two incredible guests, Kristen and Christine, the authors of a brand new book, Spectrum on the Independence, How to Teach Neurodiverse Children Daily Life Skills. So in this conversation, we're going to talk about why independence matters more than perfection, how to bring these skills into both home and school settings, and ways you can start seeing progress one small step at a time. So grab your coffee and let's get started. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. So before we get in, I have a couple questions I always ask my guests, but I'd like to ask you separately kind of what got you to the place of writing this book, what you guys do to help families strategize during or throughout the special education journey.
So how the book came to be is actually really interesting. Christine and I were at an inclusive higher ed conference up in Syracuse, and we were having lunch, and the table was basically all inclusive higher ed professionals. And I was the one K-12 person at the table. There's very few K-12 people at all that attend these inclusive higher ed conferences. So it's probably an extremely small percentage of people that are from the K-12. The inclusive higher ed professionals were all talking about how a lot of times the students are arriving for their first day of inclusive higher education, and they're not as independent as they really need to be. And so after lunch, Christine and I had a talk, and I said, you know, the parents are so involved just to get them ready for this, because the school districts in many cases are not preparing them for inclusive higher ed. So the parents are really picking up a tremendous amount of slack, and then they're getting to you, and you guys kind of want them out of the picture, like just in a snap of the fingers. I said, that's a lot to ask. And I said, maybe we can write a book teaching the parents how to fade themselves over time so that it's not such this dramatic shift overnight, which isn't working for the kid. It doesn't work for the parents, and it's not working for the inclusive higher ed, you know, people either. Christine, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we actually met at Auburn. Wendy and I were talking about Auburn. And so, you know, there was an inclusive higher ed conference. And again, it's these themes that kept coming up when we would talk to parents, talk to inclusive higher ed, and talk to providers, of this like band-aid rip of just, you know, because Auburn's program called the Eagles program has an acclimation period where parents are not allowed to come onto campus or to have their young adult leave campus as part of this truly getting into living independently. And this is something that, you know, is a struggle for a lot of people. And so it's this band-aid rip, this really sudden change. And so, you know, rather than thinking, you know, we were like, oh, we're going to write a book for prepping for college. And then we started outlining that book. And then we kept outlining and adding and adding and adding and adding on. And on page, you know, 15, we were like, oh no, this is not one book. This is many books. And we really have to start. We cannot start at 17. Now, of course, yes, you can start an independence journey at 17. But ideally, we're starting much, much, much earlier for both the parents' comfort, the young adult child's comfort, and also for those practice opportunities. If we're waiting till 17 to do things independently, we have a really, everything can feel really rushed, really compressed. And versus if we start early, then we can master these skills along the way and maintain them rather than shoving as many skills in as we can before they leave for college, which again, just adds a level of stress and angst, I think, to the process that maybe doesn't need to be there.
Yeah. And this speaks to me a lot about what you're both saying in terms of kind of scaffolding the support and towards independence, starting early and building the capacity for our students in different ways. And so it also aligns with a lot of work that I do with parents in terms of their parent input statement for the IEP and starting young. And I'm always like, think about it as like 3 months, 6 months, a year. But I also want you to think about your kiddo and, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. So we can start as a team really collaborating the best we can, trying to find those resources and really prioritizing where we want to start towards that independence. And yes, obviously we can start at 17, but the earlier, the better to build the capacity for our kiddos. So tell me real quick, before we start with our whole conversation, what is something that is little known to people or our listeners that doesn't necessarily relate to what you do for work, whether it's a hobby, an interest, just something a little bit out of your norm that doesn't always get shared?
Kristen's like professional tennis.
No,
like,
I'm really not.
She's
I'm really
very
not.
Good.
I'm really not. I'm working on it. Christine Gardens.
Yes, I have 10 raised beds in my backyard and a bunch of fruit trees. And so we're at the end of tomato season right now. And so we're pulling not the last tomatoes, but the last not sad tomatoes, because August is when the bugs come out. And so you get your tomatoes with little holes in them.
Sad tomatoes.
Yeah. Yes. And we love, I mean, we grow, I have tomatoes, basil, blueberries, figs, sweet potatoes, flour. So yeah, I went a little wild when we moved into this house and built a bunch of raised beds.
It's so fun though. I have two and mine need a lot of work, but one day I'm going to be you and have multiple ones. But right now we're starting with the two and working on composting. So,
and that's the way, right? Just like independence, we build slowly. Yes. We don't need to start with 10 raised beds. That's usually too much.
All right. So a lot of us as parents walk this tightrope between wanting to protect our babies and knowing that they need this space to grow. I really always feel like it's like this place of fear and love. And so how do we start moving that shift from doing things for our kiddos to teaching them how to do things in a way that feels doable and also works, you know, in the IEP world and at home and school?
Well, I think one of the first things is one of the early chapters in the book talks about what skills a child should have to be able to be ready to be more independent and safely, right? So for example, if you have a child that engages in pica, that is not a child you want to leave alone in the bathroom with the soap and the shampoo and what, it's just not safe, right? So that's the first piece. And I think the second piece then is also, there's the whole thing about whether you're ready as a parent, right? But the next piece, as far as a child goes, is when you're doing it in small steps and it's incremental, it's not as scary, right? Like I use the example a lot when I want a child to be more independent in the community. I say to the parents, this doesn't mean that you drop them off at Target with a list and come back in an hour and a half to pick them up. Like that's a huge ask. But how about when you're grocery shopping, ask them to go to the next aisle and get something, because if they can't handle that, we're not going to take the next step off of that. And we're certainly not going to just drop them off at a Target, right? But if it's just one small step at a time and you can get comfortable with, okay, well, they can do that, that's how you build up your comfort just as much as you're building up their confidence.
Yeah. And my kind of examples come from being in the college program. I teach sexuality and relationship education. So things like healthy relationships, consent, boundaries, you know, different role, strangers, acquaintances, friends, family, the different roles people have, and how we behave with those people in those different roles. And I get a lot of questions from parents, you know, and I present to the parents of students who are applying for the program. So they have not even gotten into the program. And we get questions like, you know, well, what if my kid's not ready? And this is the point where I am, again, as someone who teaches college, I'm able to say, it actually doesn't matter. It actually doesn't matter what they're ready for or what you're ready for. They have reached an age and they have reached a stage of coming to college and they have to have this information. So it's also kind of thinking about what information does my child need based on their age and what their peers are getting. So that's a different shift. You know, that's something that I think a lot of parents hesitate, right? What is my child ready for as far as information and skills? But also we have to think about what is the world going to ask of them? What do they need? And that's a different framing for people. And that can be a lot harder, especially when we start talking about topics that make people feel a little uncomfortable. But, you know, again, like I go back to, you know, teaching people the right names for their body parts and for other people's body parts, right? You're not ready or not ready to learn those words. You need them. They're important. If you're going to the doctor, if you need to report something has happened to you, those words are critical, whether you're ready or not ready. And so I come at it from sort of that angle of, you know, if they're coming to college, this is what they need, regardless of, you know, what you feel ready for.
And that makes sense to then help parents kind of break that down to reduce some of that overwhelm, right? So if you're thinking of, you know, starting as young as we can, what is one tiny thing that we can do to help reduce the overwhelm? And, you know, and it is overwhelming because you think, well, they need this, they need this, they need this. But then kind of think about what are the top three things that you see now? And then let's put them in order and then go from there. Kind of almost like what you guys did with the book and even best practice when we teach, right? Like put all the information and then, all right, let's step this back, step this back, step this back. Okay, this feels comfortable. All right, I can make this little incremental shift when doing that. Because it certainly is, again, that fear and love when it's your baby, everything seems overwhelming. Not everything, but, you know, just of how do we move them forward and how do we see our student and how they see themselves navigating the world around them?
Yeah, so in general, we follow like the developmental trajectory, right? So if your child isn't potty trained or they're not brushing their teeth, you're not going to start working on showering. Showering is a lot of steps. That's like sort of, you're going to have a couple of skills under your belt already before you move to showering. If you don't have like communication skills with your child, you can go back and forth. You're not leaving them home alone. Because if there's a problem, how are they calling you to tell you that there is a problem, right? So everything has prereq skills that need to be taught, or skills that just naturally are easier or occur before the others that you would do first, before you move yourself up to the more advanced skills. I think where the panic comes is that those earlier skills aren't being worked on. And then all of a sudden a parent's like, oh my God, my kid's supposed to be home alone for the night. I would never do. I'm like, okay, have you left them home alone for 5 minutes to go to the neighbor's house? And they're like, well, no. And I'm like, well, that's where we would start. So if you haven't done that, of course there's going to be panic about the thought of leaving them home overnight.
But yeah, when you go to the pool, you don't jump off the high dive where the Olympian divers dive off of, right? You learn how to put your head underwater and hold on to the side. And, I think a lot of times because people are thinking far down the road and they're thinking for these like final things, it feels like you have to go from 0 to 100, but that's just not how anything works. Like, I think, I can't remember if we included this in the book or it got cut, but you know, we don't go from a couch to a marathon. And this is something that you could have all the motivation in the world, but if you don't have the skills, you're not running the marathon. And so thinking through, again, like Kristen said, these little things that you can do that you arrive at the finish line not stressed and scared. You went from, you know, leaving them over an evening, you know, leaving them alone in the morning to get ready in the morning versus, oh, I have to leave them overnight and they have to get ready for school all by themselves. It's a lot, and it doesn't need to happen all in one go, and it shouldn't happen all in one go. You're kind of setting everybody up for stress and probably failure on some level.
So let's switch just a little bit. When we think about kind of that homeschool community, and for a second, let's look at the school component. And the way the IEPs are typically set up is more in kind of this deficit model versus a neuroaffirming model. So how can we help parents? So when we meet parents and they feel like school only sees limits, how can we help them reframe and reimagine kind of the possibilities for their kiddos and really inviting that conversation, collaboration with the school team to help kind of change that deficit to more neuroaffirming?
I know that in my cases, some of the big things that we do is, first, I always tell the parents, let's have a goal. And it needs to be a big goal, because if we don't reach it, we don't reach it. But if we have a small goal, we're not really challenging ourselves. So hypothetically, let's say we're aiming for inclusive higher ed, or even just general college. Go in and tell your school, this is what we are aiming for, and I need you guys on board to get us from point A to point B. The second thing is, when you're working on these skills at home, you want to keep the school district updated on your progress. You want to let them know, like, we're working on X, Y, and Z, and this is the progress that we've made. If a school says to you, I hear this a lot, you know, we're having a lot of trouble with the morning routine, and your son's not doing it independently. Okay, great. Tell me exactly, what are you supposed to be doing? What the problem is? And not that you're going to be able to mimic it exactly at home, but there might be something you could do at home to facilitate what's happening at school. I also find a lot of times, the minute you start questioning why they haven't made progress on something, all of a sudden, things start to change. We start to change how we're teaching it. We start to change the reinforcement, whatever. And now all of a sudden, things are moving. And so there needs to be a lot of collaboration / checks and balances as far as what's going on.
Yeah. And I think absolutely that check-in process for parents, whether it's just doing a little memo record on your phone and sending it, or a quick message through an app that a school district uses to communicate, however that may be. But I think letting the school know absolutely can help. How does that then get put into the opportunity for kind of higher, more achievable goals? I think kind of what you were saying is, let's think of something high and then work.
When you have the end goal, you sort of know what is required. So for example, if you're goal is inclusive higher ed, there are certain criteria that you need to have, or certain skills you need to have to be a candidate for that. And then that's when you sort of backtrack. Well, if he needs to be able to stay home, let's see, like self-advocacy is a big one, right, for inclusive higher ed, and that cuts across both areas. So if he needs to be able to advocate for himself in college, what can we be doing now to start teaching him to advocate for himself at home and school at an easier level, right? And even the staying home overnight, that can be worked on in both areas. Does the school even trust a child to go drop something off at the office, you know, or to go to the bathroom by themselves and come back? Because if you don't trust them to do that, you're not really trusting them to stay home alone either for any amount of time. So I think there are in many cases ways that school and home can be working on these earlier skills that lead up to eventually getting to these higher schools. And the earlier you start, the more time you have to work on all the steps.
Well, and I'm just going to say, again, from the college level, the self-advocacy for accommodations is really important. So we have an Office of Accessibility. All of our students meet with accessibility support staff who put in their formal accommodations into a letter that is then sent to all of their faculty, their professors, anyone that they interact with academically. You would be surprised, maybe you wouldn't be surprised actually, how many students show up and do not know what their accommodations are for academics. They don't know that they get extra time. They don't know that they get things read out loud to them. Maybe they know they get them read out loud, but they don't realize that that's an accommodation, that not everyone else has that. They don't know that they get breaks. They don't know that they get to use a fidget toy. They don't know. And so again, it's also including your child in these discussions and labeling these things as support or accommodations, rather than you just need a little extra help. Well, that is true, but saying that to an accommodations officer or, you know, worker, I just need a little extra help, does not actually describe the support that they need. And again, that could be advocacy for themselves on a job site. It could be advocacy for themselves in their classrooms. It could be advocacy for themselves in the community, saying, I just need a minute. If they need extra time to process, learning to be able to say, the waiter standing at the table, are you ready to order? I just need a minute. That is self-advocacy. And so those things take time to get fluent in. and you need to rehearse those things and you need to help them. So again, a young adult going to a gen ed classroom or a co-teach classroom or a resource classroom, being able to tell the teacher, I use a calculator, I use this, I have this. That's a really concrete target that the school can work on, as well as parents at the same time. So it's finding these things that bridge, and they might not look the same in the two contexts, but you can be working on self-advocacy across. You can be working on, you know, self-help adaptive skills across. So maybe you brush your teeth after lunch at school. You can't shower, obviously, but you could brush your teeth. And then we're working on brushing teeth at home and at school. And so again, there are things that can go across, and there's no reason, just because they look a little different, doesn't, you know, that helps with generalization. Having multiple people working with your child on those skills can help with generalization across multiple contexts.
And you have a neat perspective, because you are, Christine, at the college level, in terms of seeing kids that come in with the capacity with advocacy. Is there any other kind of little nuggets that you've seen really work well in building that for our students when they're leaving that K through 12 for higher learning?
Okay, first thing, I view things really negatively. That's my sort of slant, is finding the problem. And so, great way to flip that question around on me. I appreciate that. And I would say that Kristen and I together bring the perspective of preparation, and then I bring this. I've seen it when they get to me. So I'm super appreciative of all of Kristen's advocacy at the K-12 level, because when I was in K-12, I didn't even know inclusive higher ed existed. So I didn't even know that this was possible for my students. And so I'm really grateful for her perspective. Yeah, so for our students, time management. Students who have, and we're not just talking time management as in I put it in my calendar. We're talking, I'm in my dorm room, my class starts at 11. What time do I need to be up? What time do I need to be brushing my teeth? What time, I need a plan for food, because I'm not going to have time to go get lunch between my 11 o'clock class and my 1 o'clock class. So I need to pack myself a protein bar. And then I need to leave at 10:30 to walk all the way across. College campuses are massive now. If you weren't on a massive college campus when you went to college, let me tell you, miles they put on these campuses. And I need to leave then to be there on time. So it's this backward planning that students who have it are far and away more prepared. They're not stressed about getting to places on time. The anxiety comes down, versus a student who is like constantly checking their phone or their app. Where am I supposed to be? What time? And so that is a big skill that we see that a lot of students struggle with. They'll schedule something for 10 and something for 11, and then they do not schedule any time in between for either food, drink, or getting from place to place. So that skill is huge for our students on college campuses.
It's really, I think you guys referred to that as a recipe for independence. Is that right? And kind of thinking of just task analysis and breaking things down and working backwards. How can a parent kind of explain that in language that everybody's going to understand, and that we can still work on that bridge between school and home?
Well, I just want to jump in. So there's two different pieces here. You have the working backwards, right? Which is maybe your end goal is for your kid to be able to get ready in the morning independently. That's a big goal. And we're not going to tackle that like at one time. So we're going to work backwards, and we're going to say, what are the steps to getting ready in the morning? Well, they need to know when to get up. They need to brush their teeth. They need to get dressed, have breakfast, make sure their bag is packed, right? And then we're going to tackle each one of those independently. And then that's when the task analysis comes in. So the child's having trouble brushing their teeth. Okay, well, let's figure out, there's 20 steps or something. We have this in the book, 22 steps or something like that to brushing your teeth. Are they having trouble with all of the 22 steps? Are they distracted and just not brushing their teeth? Like, what would happen if you just sent them in there to brush their teeth? Or what we see a lot is that they're really only stuck on specific components. So maybe there's two or three of those 22 steps that they're stuck on. And then it comes down to, well, how do we teach or accommodate those couple of steps? And then as far as, again, like working with the school on this. It's for them, it's the bigger goal. So it's not just like, I want my child to get ready in the morning. It's, you want to go big with them. I want my child, you know, if, I think not every child is capable of this, but if they're capable, I want my child to be able to go to some sort of higher ed program and or a trade program, or just be able to be ready for competitive employment and ideally to live as independently as possible. So if that's our goal, I don't care how far we are from it right now. If that's our goal, what do we need to do? How can we backtrack to close that gap from where we want to be to where we are now? And then anything that is those more isolated tasks, such as maybe unpacking their bag when they get to school, that's something that a task analysis can be put in for. And you can suggest it to the school. So, hey, you're having a lot of trouble. I see they're having a lot of trouble unpacking. I'm getting notes every day that they need a lot of prompting to get, you know, get their bag unpacked or to keep their locker organized or whatever. So did you try this? Did you try breaking it down for them in this way? We had a fascinating conversation, or actually it was a review that we got, and the person herself was on the spectrum. And she said, this was so interesting because I didn't realize that neurotypical people view toothbrushing as one task. Like, of course it's 22 different tasks. Like, you know, and so I think sometimes there's just this gap between how some people see things and how other people see things. And it's a matter of bridging that gap.
What are some advice that you have for parents? And I think kind of all of this, right? So prepping for independence and thinking through those things, because if we were thinking of toothbrush or brushing our teeth as 20 some steps, and then from there we're, you know, washing our face and like all of these elements, then thinking of it that way does seem overwhelming. And so what advice do we have for parents, both on the younger side and then as they're going into college and are going towards independence, to really kind of help with, I guess I'm trying to figure out how to word my question here, in terms of figuring out, like, we talk about data at a school, you know, in a school and an IEP, and how to communicate that and how to kind of figure out where to start and how to continue to move forward.
Yeah. So in the book, we walk through parents through a process of, basically, they list all the routines that their child engages in a week. Then we get down to how many of them do you do every day? Because we want multiple practice opportunities, preferably multiple opportunities a day to practice. So that's why toothbrushing comes up so often, because you're doing that twice a day, every day, regardless of whether it's school or break or whatever. And so a lot of people will probably start there, but they could start with face washing. If their child washes their face twice a day, that works great too. And then we're setting ourselves up for success by working on one routine at a time. This is not something that you are tackling 10 at the same time. You do one routine at a time and you then build on that success. So as your child becomes more independent in doing one activity, you can start to work on other routines, and they are then used to you not doing it for them. So this is another stumbling block, right? Is for a lot of our young people, children, all the way to young adults and even adults, they are happy to sit and wait until someone comes and does it for them. And so that inertia, if we get them out of it in one routine, we can start using that to work on other routines. So these skills, they feel isolated, right? Toothbrushing is one skill, a set of skills, but it's also following a task analysis, which is a skill in and of itself. Doing things independently, that is a skill. Staying on task, because there's a motivator at the end. There's something, you know, we're going to brush our teeth and then we're going to go to the park, right? So staying on task first then is a skill. First we brush our teeth, then we go to the park. That's a skill. And so you're working on, in name, toothbrushing, but you're also working on all of these other skills that you can bring to bear on other routines when you start working on them too. So it doesn't feel like you're working on them in the moment, right? You're not labeling them that way. You're just working on toothbrushing. But there's all these undergirding things that when they get mastered in the context of toothbrushing, it's a lot easier to drag them over into getting dressed in the morning or getting your bag packed. And so that's one way to kind of think about it, that yes, we're targeting one, but there's all these things going on within that routine that we can bring to bear on other things.
How do we then keep this independence goal kind of front and center when you just said, you know, right? Other adults may say it's just easier if we do it for them. So how do we kind of keep that front and center when maybe it's a, you know, somebody outside of your home, whether it's a teacher or somebody or even a family member, I guess, could say, you know, I don't quite see this as a need yet.
It's easier to do it for them in the moment, right? Especially if you're a parent and you're rushing to get out in the morning. It's not easier to do it for them in the long haul. And as far as school goes, again, there's just got to be this consistent reminder of this is what we're aiming for. This is the progress we're making at home. I have parents, sometimes the child will get tested and they'll fill out some sort of adaptive scale. The teacher will fill it out and the parent will fill it out. And there's this tremendous difference. Like the parent's score is so much higher than the school score. Now, I know all the parents that I work with because I have a small practice. And yes, you always have, you know, that one parent that like overscores their kid. And I'm like, okay, they can't do all these things. But I had this one parent in particular, she usually underscores her kid. Usually I have to go back in and say, wait, we can give him a little bit more credit here. So when her stuff comes back as this much higher than the schools, I'm like, we got a problem at school, because I know that these are accurate scores. And if he's at this level, say on a scale from 1 to 10, he's like a 6 at an independence level at home, and he's a 2 at school. Now we know we need to have a conversation. Why is this so low? What are you guys seeing here? What are you changing? What are we doing to make this better? And it's just continuing to bring attention to it and continuing to insist that you have big goals for your child, that your child has big goals for themselves. And then in order to get from, you know, that point A to point B, these are things that we need to be working on.
Well, and even things like time delay, right? So if you are a teacher's aide and you have 5 students to get ready to go to the lunchroom, and you have to have them get their lunch out of their backpack and stand in line, and this student takes longer for whatever reason, whether they've got the learned helplessness where they're, or we call it prompt dependency, where they become dependent on prompts, then maybe they get extra time, and maybe you as the aide are feeling rushed, and so you just grab their backpack and get their lunch out for them. But that's not actually where the child is, where they could be. And so maybe you give them time to process that it's time to go to lunch. Maybe you start prompting them through it. And maybe they're a little motivated to get moving because lunch is on the other end of getting this thing done. And so instead of going in and getting that for them, maybe you are pointing at the backpack and unzipping it a little bit. And then they reach in and get the lunch for themselves or open the zipper. And so time delay is a powerful tool if there is something delicious or wonderful on the other side. Just putting that little pause of like, I'm going to hang out here. And maybe you divide and conquer. And maybe the teacher and the aide stay with the one student and the other aide takes the other 4 out of the room. And we hang out for a second and we say, hey, bud, it's time to go to lunch. Let's get your lunch bag. And so rather than having to adhere to the schedule of the other students or adhere to this like time limit, we let the time limit work for us. Like, oh man, we're missing out on lunch. We better get going. We don't want the hallway to be too busy. You know, there's ways to slow it down rather than just, oh, we got to get everybody. Cause I know like these classrooms are wild. There's 20,000 things going on at the same time in a resource classroom or in a life skills classroom, but that doesn't mean that we need to do everything for them. And the thing that we tell parents often is, can that go with them? So is that aide going to go to college with them? Is that aide going to go to their employment with them and be able to get them their lunch bag every time? And if the answer is no, then we need to plan to fade that support, and not when they turn 21 and we rip the Band-Aid off. But we need to be planning way ahead so that they have those skills when they leave, rather than it just being the phrase we use is falling off a cliff, right, at 21. And we don't want that to happen.
What is a tactful way you've seen either parents or professionals invite others into that independence building process so it doesn't just seem like a mom is just constantly like, bring, bring, email, email. Like, what is the, just have you seen or have any suggestions for that?
It's very challenging. I always tell parents, if you can keep it peaceful with the school district, it's in everybody's best interest. You don't want to make it adversarial. And I also always tell parents, I have a really good working relationship with other professionals when they're doing their job properly. But when they're not, we have a problem because I'll ask for things that they know they should have. And when they cannot give them to me, whether it's data, whether it's a report, whether it's goals, whatever it is, people start to get really defensive. And I always tell the parents, this is not good because stuff I'm asking them for, this is their job. And so they're not doing their job. And this is why your child's not making progress, because things aren't being done properly. It's a very challenging situation. I tell parents all the time, no school is perfect. I don't care what school you have your kid in, public school, private school, special ed school, gen ed school. They all have certain things that they do well, and they all have certain things that they're maybe not meeting your child's needs for. And your goal is to figure out how can you maximize what's happening during that day, and what do you need to supplement outside of school?
And you can also think about, so this is a hard one, for transition support. So who is at the table? Should vocational rehabilitation be at the table? Should their employer, if they have a part-time job or a volunteer, should they be at the table? Should we invite in an employment coach? Should we, you know, these are things, having outsiders, I think sometimes, depending, like Kristen was saying, if they're not doing what they need to do, can feel like a threat. But if the school is doing a good job and they are planning for transition, then they should be welcoming the input of the transition support person in the school district, right? Having them come in to your IEPs early, because I know it's, I think 16 and above is when you have to start planning for transition, which is very late, in my opinion. Some places it's 14, which feels a little better. But if we're talking about our students who take 10 times as long to learn something through, you know, repetition, they need multiple repetitions, or it just takes them longer for motor reasons. You know, these things need to start earlier. We can't throw them in at 16 and expect them to be ready at 18 to graduate. So I would say the earlier you get these, like, transition, vocational rehab, these people that it's their job to plan for transition involved, the better. That could look like parent advocates. That could look like getting your transition assistance center involved. And so there are ways. I would say inviting them before there's a problem is ideal. So rather than kind of pushing back from a table where you just had a go about transition planning and saying, well, I'm going to invite so-and-so, versus, hey, we want to start transition planning. I have contacted these people at the state or these people at the district level, and I would like them included in my child's IEP meeting and planning. It's a very different tone than, well, I'm upset because you aren't doing what you need to do, and I'm going to call in these people who are going to tell you about yourself. Very different. And so, again, if we can find these people and these resources before we are getting into it, you know, that would be best. But Kristen and I aren't necessarily experts at tact, but we do our best.
I want to add to what Christine said. You know, there's what happens in a perfect world, and there's even what's supposed to happen legally in an IEP meeting, and then there's what actually happens. I have had, I think, zero occasions where there's been an appropriate transition plan put in for a student in all the years I've been doing this. The reality
is where school districts fall flat.
Yeah. Did you say appropriate or inappropriate?
Zero where an appropriate one has been put in place. They're just not done. I mean, I had a parent just tell me a few weeks ago, she goes, do you know my school district has an Access VR rep? She goes, I don't know who this is. Nobody told me about this. And now she's trying to track down who the person is. Like, it shouldn't be that hard. Right. And I had another point now.
It's also a new system, right? So parents have to learn, right? So there's EI or whatever we do for early intervention. That's a whole system, right? Part C. Then we get into the school, and that's a new system to have to navigate. Then we get in, and transition has its own three-letter acronyms, has its own support people that have often no connection to the school, which is wild. And so it's every stage, parents are having to navigate a new system. And yes, some of those skills transfer, right? You learn how to fill out a form, you learn how to navigate, you learn how to work with a case manager or whoever. But then when you start getting adult services and transition are a different beast, different organizations, different wait lists, different Medicaid waivers, and it varies state by state. So even if Kristen and I wanted to say like, okay, here's who you call and here's what you do, that would be for New York and Alabama. It might be very different in even Connecticut and Florida or California. And so it's a tangled web, unfortunately. And parents are tired, right? They are tired. They've maybe gotten school kind of figured out. We're not having to get called all the time for us to come get them. We've kind of figured out an equilibrium. And then it's time for transition planning. And that's another new thing to do. So it's a lot. It's a lot that parents are asked to do, especially if the school is not facilitating that transition in the way they're supposed to or reaching out to the right people. And I will say, when I was teaching, I taught middle school, I knew nothing. The way I was trained to plan for transition, because I was a teacher who had an economics degree and got a social studies teaching certificate, because Texas, if you get one certificate, you just sit for the test, and suddenly I was certified EC through 21 special education. I could do anything. I could do anything, apparently, allegedly. And so they were like, oh yeah, the way we do transition is you ask them questions about what they want to do. You write them down and you check the box that says you did transition planning if they're 14. And so that's what I knew. I didn't know anymore. And so it's also an issue of educating teachers. And yeah, them right. Educating themselves and seeking out all of this information, because we have a district in our area that we have a lot of students come from, and their high school special ed teachers help them with their applications to the Eagles program, because there's a video component, there's essays, there's forms to fill out, there's letters of recommendation to request, and their teachers are helping facilitate. Of course, the parents are helping as well, but that's the only school district we've really had where it's not just one teacher. It's that those teachers are all trained in how to help with transition, but that's a choice the district made. That's money and PD and time that they have put into those teachers that not all school districts are doing. And you can see, you know, we have, I don't know, 6 students out of 24, let's say, are from that school district.
I just want to jump in with 2 things here. One is about the IEP, and the other is about the teachers. As far as the teachers go, it's much higher than that, because I've had this conversation with one of the inclusive higher ed committees that our state has. And I was on the phone with one of them one day, and I said, you know, this is ridiculous. I live in an area where people, for the most part, on average, are educated. They have resources, whether it's financial resources, access to resources. English is their first language. I said, and they do not know about half of the stuff that exists. They don't know what they're entitled to. They're going into these IEP meetings and not getting what they really not only need, but are entitled to for their child. I said, where does that leave the rest of the parts of the country where either they're not as educated and they're not showing up to a meeting sort of confident to battle all, you know, the school districts will show up with 8 people sometimes, and you're showing up as a parent and you feel so outnumbered, or God forbid, English isn't their first language and they're not accommodating that. I mean, I have parents, they can't even navigate the meeting in their native language. And now you're going to have a parent come into a meeting and they can't follow the language, let alone everything else that's happening. I said, the parents are being taken advantage of on some level, like left and right. And what she said to me is, everything that you're talking about like lobbying the state for change up at that level so that it trickles down into the districts. So I'm saying, how come when Syracuse held State of the Art Conference for Inclusive Higher Ed, there was like 4 people there from K-12? It's a 4-hour drive from Long Island, which means everybody else in the state can make it there in a decent amount of time. They have their own hotel. It's affordable. As far as I was concerned, every single district in New York should have had a representative there. Every single one. There was two of us, me and somebody from one of the BOCES from New York State. There's no reason for that to be happening where these parent, where the schools aren't going and educating themselves on this. The other thing that I think it's very, very confusing is that an IEP stands for an individual education plan. Okay. Parents are led to believe that we are customizing this program for your child. That is not how it actually works in the real world. The real world is the school has these three classes and we're going to fit your kid into one of these three classes and we're going to make it work. Your kid needs job skills. Okay, well, we offer X and Y. If your kid needs W, it's not our problem. We're offering you X and Y. We'll stick X or Y on the IEP and we'll say that it's individualized because we gave you a choice of two, even though that's maybe not what your kid needed. And so I think it's very important for parents to realize and go into these meetings knowing that the school is looking to fit their child into pre-existing programs. It's not as individualized as you are led to believe that it is. And that is part of what leads to problems, especially when you're trying to get ready for transitioning. If your school as a whole is not encouraging kids to apply for inclusive higher ed, or encouraging kids who are neurodiverse but have an average IQ to apply to college where they can get support, then it's very hard to get them to have goals in place because their whole program's not set up for that.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation and podcast. But I mean, you're right in terms of from a parent's perspective, having to educate yourself and be okay going into this meeting where it's like, I often say this, you know, you're walking into a party, the music stops and everybody looks at you and they offer you the smallest, most crookedy chair to sit at and to have these conversations about something that's so near and dear and personal, your baby, and then to be able to have to know what questions to ask. And so I do think having conversations with parents and educating them in terms of, you know, what is there, what is the options, and what can we do that's creative out of the box that we can still work into the school system for that support and growth.
Yeah. And you would think that would mean they would be more excited about having outside folks coming in who can provide that information. Because again, a job coach could work with the school, but there's a lot of red tape.
Yeah.
Versus the school district where they have someone who's already VR on staff, but then they're not even making that connection for the parent. So again, it's asking the questions early. It's advocating often. And I think so where I am, we have students from really small towns and parents will say that they did not advocate for X, Y, or Z because there is a younger sibling coming up after them and they don't want, basically they're afraid of retaliation against the younger sibling for the parents being squeaky wheels. And so that is a real concern, right? This is not something they made up in their head. And if you live in a small enough town, you know, the superintendent lives in the same neighborhood as you, or, you know, these are not untouchable people. These are your neighbors. And so, you know, you don't want to be the one that sues the school. You don't want to be the one that calls the advocate. So you have to weigh the pros and cons and think about things really differently than, you know, somebody who lives in a bigger school district and, you know, people don't know them or it's real, but it's something that you have to make the decision of what is the hill to die on, metaphorically, right? Where is the line in the sand? And I think elementary school, you know, we're learning our academics, we can kind of maybe float along, we're getting our stuff. But as far as transition, it has to be individualized. It has to be individualized on such a different level than academic support. You know, if you're interested in agriculture, you're going to need a different set of courses. You're going to need a different set of job training. You're going to need a different set than someone who's interested in hospitality. And so it really does have to be individualized more. I don't want to say more, but it's true, right? You know, if you're learning reading, writing, and arithmetic, everybody is also learning that. But when they start to diverge into their areas of interest, that's where we really have to get into that individualization.
Can we then just talk a little bit about kind of even where we started about independence matters more than perfection and kind of reframing that messy independence so that it still feels like a win?
Yeah,
we love Peter. Peter's wonderful. Go ahead, Kristen.
Everything is steps, and it might be messy, but if you're moving forward, at some point you'll look back and be like, oh wow, look at where we were and look at where we are now. If you get too caught up on perfection, you're not going to move. And you also have to remember that a lot of these skills continue to get fine-tuned over time, right? So I have some kids who are learning how to drive right now, and I'm always reminding them, I didn't go from getting my license to being this great driver. Like, that's not what happened. I got my license, and I think it was another 4 years before I actually drove off the island and went over the Throgs Neck Bridge. Like, that, it took time to get there. And same with like brushing their teeth. You know, no child goes from not brushing their teeth to brushing their teeth perfectly. Just like with a spoon, I always tell parents, no child, even if they're neurotypical, picks up a spoon one day and uses it beautifully. It's a mess for a while until they figure out how to use the spoon, right? And that's with everything. You know, I remember learning how to wash my hair. My God, my sister and I both, it was like, every once in a while, there was a night we'd come out of the shower and my mom would be like, oh my God, you still have shampoo in your hair. And we'd be beside ourselves. We'd have to go back in and rinse it out again. But like that, you know, does that happen to me now? No. But as a kid, there's a learning curve for everything that you learn.
Well, and our foreword is from Peter Gerhardt, and he talks about this idea of also making it your own. So when I was learning to drive, to go with that, my uncle, I was learning stick shift. So yeah, to start learning to drive and stick shift at the same time. And I remember putting my hand in the non-ideal spot. And he said, listen, you can make it your own after you are safe. We're not going to do some funky business with our hands, though. We're going to keep it ideal at the beginning, and then you make it your own when you're safe. But the other thing is that Peter talks about is he does his laundry. He doesn't sort it colds or warms. I think he does it by like...
No, he sorts by article, all the socks.
There we go. All the socks. But who cares? Who cares? He is able to have clean clothes, and he has a system that works for him. You know, there are people who will advise you if there's a spot in your house that gathers stuff, right? We all have that like landing zone in our house. Well, except for Kristen, who keeps her house immaculate. But some of us have a landing zone, and you just put a basket there. You put a basket there and you put all that stuff in there. And then once a week, you go distribute that stuff back where it belongs. Now, does that mean that my house has baskets in it? Yeah, it does. Are those a bad thing? No. And it helps me keep my house in order. So it's also about finding the things that work for the person as an individual. So let's say your young adult wants to shower and then brush their teeth. Okay, great, perfect. We're still getting that done. You know, your young adult wants to wear some foolishness to school that you think is ugly, but is in their fashion sense. Are they warm enough? Do they have a coat if it's cold? Like, those are the things that we can allow play in that is not going to be the end of the world. And so, yeah, our, you know, Kristen talks about the parents who are like, oh no, we can't let them do that. And she'll just ask why, why? And a lot of what it comes back to is fear and anxiety, and the parent mm-hmm. having to change and trust and let go in safe ways. Right. Again, we're not saying drop them off at the movies and say with no cell phone and say, okay, great, I'll see you in and out. Like, that's, you know, be reasonable, be sensible, but also examine. You know, we have a section about, are you ready for your child to be independent? And having some self-reflection, what are these barriers? Why, if I'm saying no a bunch, what is that no about? Is it about safety? Is it about my anxiety? Is it about having let go? What is that about? Because sometimes it's all three, sometimes it's just one, sometimes you don't know, but exploring that can really help too, of not feeling like you're abandoning your child to the toothbrushing wolves. You know, we're just stepping back slowly, slowly.
And what an excellent reminder. There's so many things that you guys have said that reminded me just of my journey with my three, but what you just said, when my youngest was going to kindergarten and I still had a baby in a bucket and a toddler, and I was feeling so good because we were getting to school on time. And I'm walking him across the street and he has his little Crocs. And yes, it was winter. But I was like, we're on time. He is actually going towards the school day, the building, which sometimes that wasn't always happening. And we had lunch. So I was like, we're winning. And I come back after we dropped him off and a person at the school, an adult at the school said, well, you know, it is getting winter. He should not probably not wear Crocs. And I was like, we're on time and he has lunch. That's all I got right now.
And he's wearing
socks. There's socks in his backpack. If you want to make him wear Crocs and socks.
Great. But listen, great. I got him to you. Breakfast, lunch, he's dressed. So it is that perspective of a parent of thinking of, yes, you know, where is this fear coming from? And get that fear in love. And how do we break that down in a way that everybody feels good and safe about it? So as we kind of wind down our conversation today, what is one thing that I did not ask that I should have asked?
I mean, your interview was perfect. So I don't know how.
Oh, gosh, let me just make that a clip.
Kristen, what do you think?
I don't know. We haven't been asked that question.
Well, and this is new. We've been on some podcasts that have come from professionals and from parents, but we haven't had to tie in the school and the IEP connection. So this one has really been a good like brain opener to think about that, because in the book we even tossed back and forth having a chapter on IEP planning and all of that, but it also felt like kind of a tack on that might just overwhelm, because you really, yeah, that's a lot of information. And so we ended up deciding, you know, to keep that kind of separate. But yeah, I think that just bringing in those IEP questions and how to handle it with the school is something that we have not had to think about. We threw around a lot of things because there's so much to put into this topic, but even like, you know, we were talking about like which professionals to bring to the table and if we even want to do that, because there are some parents who don't have professionals, right? They live in a rural area or they live in an area of the country where there just aren't, there's a miles long wait list and they're really doing it by themselves. And so we wrote the book for them to do it by themselves. And I think you bringing in those IEP questions was really excellent and really kind of opened my thinking about what we needed to think about for the next book as well. So thank you for that.
Oh, I love that there's a next book in play there. That makes me happy.
Hope so.
Look, hold
so.
On. Let's, we yeah. are, we, there's like 10 books.
Yeah, we have a whole series
planned out because you know, there's independence in the home, independence in the community, and then independent living. And so we're like, what if we did like 3 to 4 books per sort of subtopic? But yeah, there's a lot and there's so much that I think parents are hungry for. Yeah. And, you know, the thing that breaks my heart, and I don't know about, you know, but I will have parents say, I needed this book 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I needed this book 15 years ago. I needed this, I'm going to read it anyway, but I needed it a long time ago and it just wasn't there. And that hurts because, you know, it couldn't have been us, right? We weren't doing this exact work 15 years ago, but the fact that parents don't have a resource, they don't have a parent-friendly, usable resource for this. We were shocked. Like we had to do, if you've ever written a book, listeners, you have to do these things called comps where you look at other books in your area. And we looked and we looked and we just couldn't find anything, which like good for us, I guess, terrible for everyone else.
It is such a need. And, you know, from my middle son, he's a brain cancer survivor, and I've had to be on that side of the table. And I remember initially thinking kind of what Kristen said, this, it shouldn't be that hard. And I was like, I have a master's in special ed. Like, so that then became my why of the podcast, the Special Ed Strategist podcast. And then I created a course on helping parents understand the special education eligibility evaluation process. And it's $19 and I wanted it that way so it would be accessible to parents so that they can understand and learn this process, because it is overwhelming. And again, for somebody with a background in special ed, found it overwhelming because it's your baby. And what questions to ask. And back to your point, like, how far do you push? And are you a squeaky wheel? And how do you do it tactfully? And there's just a lot of moving parts to it. So having this conversation and having you guys here today and your book as a resource is incredible. so that parents can get the information they need so they can feel empowered to then pass that on to their babies, whether their babies are baby babies or, you know, soon to be adult babies. It doesn't matter, but just giving them the skills so that they can then feel independent and the capacity that aligns with who they are as a learner and as an individual.
Yes. And Christine and I also, we really did write the book so that parents can assess it, access it in case they did not have providers. But we also set it up so that if a parent reads the book and needs help, that they can reach out to us. And we are through like coaching are able to help them in regardless of what state that they are in. You know, our hope is that parents will have therapists available to them that will do the book with them. But we know that that's not always the case.
So on this final note, how do folks find you?
Well, the book has its own website, spectrumofindependence.com. It has links to the book. There's a PDF that if you put your email in, it will be sent to you having to do with the different levels of independence, sort of like a basic, intermediate, and advanced independence, and it breaks certain tasks down. And then I also have a company website, zealbehavior.com.
So I'm at Auburn, and so the Auburn website, but spectrumofindependence.com, you'll see pictures of me that don't look like me because that's what happens when you get headshots done. I like can't even use them as my Zoom down screen because then when they would turn it on and see me, they'd be like, who is that lady? So the website is beautiful. Our website design guy did an excellent job. And so I have that. And then Auburn, I only have limited availability that I can do other things. They're very protective of their faculty's time, but I can consult when I can. So I would start with Kristen and then, you know, if it makes more sense for me to help, I can help.
Well, and sometimes it's just a matter of giving parents information. Like Christine just had a parent reach out to her and it wasn't a matter of needing to work with her on a regular basis. It was more that she just needed to be pointed in the right direction.
Yeah.
And I get a lot of those calls also, just in general, you know, I'm like, you're not in the right
to start.
Yeah. Let me send you to where you need to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Incredible. Incredible. Well, thank you so much for your time. And I know that you're just spreading so much support and good into the world. And I'm grateful for that. So thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to send that parent to you because she has lots of IEP questions. So hopefully that training that you have will help her and your resources will help her because, you know, she's doing a lot, but there's always more.
Absolutely. Anything we can do to help a parent out to kind of reduce that overwhelm, we're all doing
it
together.
Thank you so much.
I hope today's conversation with Kristen and Christine left you feeling not just informed, but encouraged. Building that independence isn't about rushing our kids to meet someone else's timeline. It's about meeting them where they are, breaking skills into doable steps, and celebrating every single win along the way. Remember, this work is not about perfection. It's about progress. Every small step your kiddo takes is a step towards more confidence for them and a little more breathing room for you. Thank you for spending time with me today. If you found this episode helpful, please follow or subscribe to the Special Ed Strategist. Also, share this with a friend so you never miss an episode, and an educator, anybody, to help boost the hopes of practical ideas and better support our community. Until next time, I'm Wendy Taylor, here to remind you that you are your kiddo's best advocate and you're not alone in this journey. Hope to see you soon. Bye for now.